if you find yourself feeling uncharitable towards someone, and you tie that to your spirit, you're going to be discouraged and disheartened, and you're going to feel out of favor with God because of the failure to understand the meaning of God's love in us. Now, if you can get hold of the principles that I've been trying to get across here, it'll help you to be at peace and to be encouraged and to be optimistic about your relationship to Christ. We must preserve that at all costs, otherwise Christ becomes, as I've said before, the guru, the religious leader who is almost never satisfied with us, who makes impossible demands. And we actually come to the point of disliking him, either continuously or off and on. We feel that we wish he wouldn't make so many demands, and I think we come to the same feeling, let us say, that a wife may have when she feels that she never does anything right. Maybe some have had that experience, or the husband may feel that way too, but partner or mate may feel everything they do gets criticized and that they never can do anything right. Perhaps you've heard that expression or given it yourself. I guess I never can do anything right. And children, young people often come to that point with parents, because it's a very common thing in a parent who is trying to raise a young person by the book to get so much of a focus on the things the young person is doing wrong that they totally forget to mention the things they're doing right. Therefore, all communication seems to center around mistakes and failures, and the young people come to feel that they never will be able to satisfy the parents. And they give up. Or they run away sometimes because they feel they've just never been able to satisfy them, never will be able to satisfy the parents. Now that exists in relationships with people, with one another, especially in families where we are much more intensely concerned about the behavior of the other members of the family. I've often said that to you, that conflicts in families arise out of the fact that we more intensely care what members of the family do than some stranger on the street. And so that gives rise to these arguments and these disappointments with each other and so forth. But the thing that we have to watch is that we do not come to the point in our relationship to people that we are so focused on their doing things right and on their failure to do things right that we leave them with the impression that we never will be satisfied with them. And I'm sure that's the impression a lot of people have of Christ, that the goal of satisfying Christ is pretty far out. And so we sort of settle for a second-rate relationship to him and assume that we're never going to be like the spiritual giants that we see here and there. Although, if you see them from a right perspective, they become the shrinking people sometimes. I mean, some of the leaders that you feel are the giants. You think they're giants because they keep saying or telling people to do things that they themselves don't do. I've run into that experience quite a bit with so-called leaders in the church, that all the time they're laying the word out on the congregation, they're making their own mistakes, but they don't bother to say that. That they're in the same grind that the people are. The upshot of these things is this, that if we get the feeling that there are so many things to do as Christians or not to do, it is hopeless to think we'll ever really come to the place where Christ is satisfied with us. That's a great feeling. That's a constant feeling. And I want you to get away from that feeling, because it's not really the spirit of the Scripture. Whereas there are verses about conduct, the overwhelming passages of Scripture in the nature of God's fatherly relationship to us. We're not His charges, we're His children. And that's why I keep pressing that issue on you, because I hope it sinks in deeply that you have reason to be at peace with Christ and to feel that even if you're making mistakes, which you are, and we all are, it's not crucial. It's not going to throw you out of the kingdom, or He's not going to get a mood on about you. Of course, we judge Christ by ourselves a lot. We know that if people don't do the things we think they ought to, that we get unhappy with them. You know, we think Christ acts the way we do. It's the old saw, we always say that nobody's perfect, but I've discovered that you jolly well better be if you're going to be the friend of some people. They're very quick to point out the failures and overlook all the good things. And I've often said, it's like when a junior is asked to mow the lawn, and the parent comes home and finds that the lawn is mowed indeed, but the grass clippings are still on the sidewalk, and the great fuss over the grass clippings on the sidewalk, and no mention made of the lawn mowed, you see. That's the nature of the thing I'm talking about. I think, as I've said so often, that Christ must be truly pleased tonight to see this group of people attending to his word. I think this would be a very joyful matter to him, that he's not looking at you thinking of all the things you did today that were scuzzy, but substandard. But the great thing that whatever our childish pranks and prattles may be, we've come together to honor him, to study the word. Now, what a glorious thing that is. Can you imagine with your own young people, for example, some of you have had children that have. Can you imagine if that teen should come in the evening and say, you know, Jay, I'd just like to spend some time with you tonight. I decided not to go out with the gang because I just felt I'd like to be at home with Mom and Dad for an evening. You know? What a glorious thing that would be. It would really make you feel good, wouldn't it? You must realize Christ feels the same way, because you people have set aside other possible pursuits and fascinations tonight to come here, to hear the word, you see, not to hear some fascinating lecture on UFOs or on cooking or something like that, but on the matters of Christ. Just think tonight how happy Christ is that you do this. And that's more prominent in his mind than other things, which are matters of discipline and conduct and growth and whatnot, but peripheral matters. And when you're relating to your young people and to your mates, husbands and wives, or what, just remember to have the friendship of someone, to have somebody that comes home at night or you come to them at night, and they're there and they care about you. Somebody cares whether things went well at work or not today, or how you feel, or what's going on. Sometimes we don't think these people care, but they do care. It's better than coming home to an empty house. Now, you see, people will drive their mates and their young people away by overlooking that point of the value of that person's friendship in order to shape them up. They want to get them so perfectly shaped up that they do everything just right and say everything just right and carry out the responsibilities of the husband or the wife or whatever just right. We try to fine-tune the relationship, and in fine-tuning it, we blow it. The relevance of that to what I've been saying here is that if we look at the Bible as a book which is trying to fine-tune our relationship to Christ, it can become such a burden, that fine-tuning process, that we lose the vitality of the friendship. It's like if you have somebody that's always telling you what to do and always criticizing you, you lose the vitality of the friendship. One of the most devastating things that ever happens in marriage is right there. Because that constant criticism and constant questioning of the other person's capabilities or motives or whatever else just finally just squeezes out all the affection, and then you go on together in sort of a team function. You're not out to make touchdowns in marriage. You're out to enjoy a relationship. On the football field, the coach and the team squabble a lot because they're trying to make touchdowns. You see, when you're not trying to make touchdowns in marriage, you're trying to get along together and have a companion with you. People, for example, wives that are so constantly criticizing the husband for not being home more is going to find that he finds more and more reasons not to be home, because when he does come home, all he gets is criticism. See? The same would be true the other way around, but this is one of the common things. A man who's out in business or something, whose time is constantly being taken up with his work, and so he doesn't get home as often as he should, But if you try the other psychology of that, and you make that time he is home the most pleasant of his week, you'll find that he will find more reasons to be home. It doesn't work the other way. If you could get him to get home more often by criticizing him, it might be a point, but that doesn't work that way. It works the other way. We have to settle for a sort of happy medium there of a certain amount of interaction, which is necessary to for people to harmonize together. And when you marry somebody, you have to learn how to get along and so forth. But you have to settle maybe for less than perfection in order to preserve the affection and the vitality of the personal relationship, even if it's somewhat imperfect. So settle for less as far as perfection is concerned, and gain more ground in the comfortable relationship that says, I can be with you because you don't always put me down or you don't always criticize me. That's a wonderful thing to be that way. So you've maybe lost a few points in terms of making that person the model husband or the model wife. You've lost a few points there, but you have gained infinitely more in making that person a willing companion who wants to be with you. All right, now you see, if we take the same tack as far as Christ is concerned and decide that maybe he isn't there just trying to keep pushing us into shape, if we take that attitude that maybe he cares about just having our companionship and not whether we're all that perfect, we might relax a little bit and just enjoy the relationship and know that if we do make a mistake, we're not going to get something thrown at us. We're going to get it passed over. So you see, like for example, the proverbial fender bender of the wife. You know, she gets the new unit banged up a little bit, and she drives home at night with that car, and she's petrified. She's scared to death because he's going to jump on her or something. What a wonderful thing if that dear poor lady could come home at night and know that the husband had enough savvy just to say, well, let's take care of it, you know, and not worry about it. I remember when my wife had a little altercation with a mailbox, and she didn't even know she'd hit a mailbox. She thought she'd hit something. It was in the dark, and so the people had begun their process of, getting some money out of it. But, you know, my attitude was, I'll just get my lawyer to go in and take care of the thing for her and to worry about it. So she didn't have to worry another minute about that matter. People came over to the house, or you want to collect money. Forget it, I said, just don't worry about it. She's more important to me than a fender or a little settlement, see. Now, I don't say that Sam is strong, right? Because I don't mean to say that everything is great, but that only that that's the kind of thing that a person who cares about another enough is going to do. If human beings can be like that, why can't we see Christ like that? So we come home to him with the fender bent, and we don't expect him to belt us one. We expect him to understand that we're human and that we make these mistakes, and we get enough penalty already trying to patch up the problems, you see, the consequences of our mistakes are penalty enough, after all. The agony of having to live out our lives in this world is penalty enough. You see, we've already suffered enough. Judge who has some understanding may take a certain case and say, well, this person has suffered enough, we're not going to attach any further penalty. Like somebody who's been a prominent figure, let's say, and they've lost their position in the community, and they've, or like some of the senators, you know, get into trouble, and they've lost their seat in the Senate, and they've lost this, and they've lost that, and so the judge may say, well, they've suffered enough, we're not going to also add some jail time to this. It's perfectly valid. So we suffer. When we make mistakes, we suffer. It isn't that we go scot-free. Now, just like this matter of love we talked about last week, and I won't talk more about it, but we get into problems with one another because of our carelessness and we lose friends over it, and we hurt people, and we get hurt back, and we pay a price. So we ought to watch our relationship to one another for our own good as well as the good of others. And all the things we're going to look at in this chapter that are graces of the Christian consciousness are important things. We ought to do things right. We shouldn't get angry at the boss and stomp out of the office. We may lose our job. But that doesn't mean if we come home at night after a day at which we've been out of sorts with people and so forth, that Christ is going to sit down and give us a lecture on it. We've already had our lecture for the day. See, that's what I'm trying to get across to you. Be at peace about Christ. Just believe that He cares about us and relates to us as you would expect and hope that the people you relate to would act toward you. The way you hope your husband would act toward you, the way you hope your wife would act toward you, the way you hope father would act or mother, that's the way Christ does act. And it's the image that has been created for Him in the hands of religionists that has been the problem. There's a large amount of idolatry going on in the church today, an abstract idolatry in which the image of Christ is painted in these terms that the religionists see Him, and they pass that on to the people rather than the true image of Christ as given in the Word. And you say, well, aren't they talking about the Bible? Well, only in this general sense. You will find that a lot of teaching in the church is based upon seminary notes. It's based upon theology books and religious systems. There is a system of belief that a given denomination has put together, and that's what they're talking about. Rarely do you find ministers taking a chapter of the Bible, for example, and going verse by verse down that chapter and telling you what it means. They may take a chapter and hit two or three verses in it and give you their three-point homily. I never give you sermons here because I don't have 3 points. I usually have 15. I violated every rule I learned in the homiletics class because I'm here to give you truth, not the Morsi system of spirituality. There are no systems to memorize. I will never write a manual or a how-to-do-it book, how to be a Christian in 6 easy lessons or something. How to be happy though a Christian or whatever, you know. Any more than I'd write a manual on how to be happy though married, you know. I've heard the line somewhere, I don't know who gave this, it's not original, but the fellow that said he didn't know how happy life could be till he got married, and then it was too late, you know. I sometimes think that as regards Christianity, that people get drawn into signing up for Christians, and after they've signed up, their life becomes miserable trying to keep up with the system. But they get stuck in it because they don't dare give it up because they don't want to go to hell, and yet they find their own hell trying to keep up with it. This is systematized religion. I would tell you it is a swindle. People are being swindled out of a beautiful relationship to Christ based upon mutual understanding and respect and grace, wherein Christ sees us as human beings who are going to be faltering. When we talk to Him about it, He isn't there waiting with a paddle, you know, to give us a licking. He wants to talk about it. It's a wonderful thing when young people can talk to parents in an open way and feel that they can share with them their mistakes as well as their triumphs and not get put down, not get whacked for it. Parents make a grave mistake here in not cultivating the openness in which a young person feels that even if they've gone out and made some bad mistake, that they can come and talk about it and they're going to get counsel and help and understanding and not the back of the hand. Parents were that way, the young people would be more readily open than they could guide them. Because after all, our concern with young people is not to penalize them, it's to teach them. I've often said that that discipline basically is a word that means to teach. And any response or discipline that doesn't teach is misapplied. Discipline that becomes matters of revenge or taking out frustrations or something like that, don't teach anything. Now, in order to teach, the young person has to sort of understand the issues, that there's some relationship between the instruction they're getting and the deed that they've done. So that way there's a combination. I don't mean to say there isn't a place for penalties. There is a place for penalties, but those penalties have to have as their chief objective impressing upon that young person the right way, rather than merely getting back at them for disobeying. Which is often the case, because parents just sort of take out their frustration, and I often have said they shoot from the lip. The young person has come in and there's been some mistake or some problem, and right away the parent just lashes out and says a lot of things, often terrible things. And those things just put scars across the psyche of that young person. Again, we're really talking about how Christ looks at us and how he handles us. If I, as a parent, can understand this kind of thing, that young people are not to be kicked around and badgered and battled, they're to be taught and trained and loved and cared for. Okay, if that's true of us as human parents, how much more of Christ, that he has the infinite patience that we don't have, because we don't have all that patience. And however good our intentions are, we do sometimes get carried away and we say things we shouldn't. If you ever do, then you've got to go back and apologize. If you ever say something to a young person that is off base, and that you later say, well, I really shouldn't have said that or done that, go back and apologize by all means. Say, look, I was out of order, I shouldn't have said that, and I'm sorry. And that'll do more to win their respect, because young people know that parents make mistakes too. And they're willing to forgive the mistake if the parent doesn't come across with the idea, I'm never wrong and I never apologize. We do make mistakes. But Christ, you see, has the grace of parenthood in an infinite degree. And if we ought to be able to feel that we can come to him and say, Lord, look, I made a mistake here, and I just want to talk to you about it, and I'm sorry. As I've said to my own young people, nothing you can ever do that is bad enough that you can't come back and put your feet under my table. You know, I want them to feel that this is where they're going to get their help, not with some stranger out in the forest somewhere. You can get it at home where people care. When young people make mistakes, they're already suffering enough often from that mistake without getting further things at home. Now, I understand when children are little, they can't always reason things out, and there has to be a point at what we call in psychology negative reinforcement. That is, when a child does something wrong, the parent knows it's wrong, a child knows it's wrong, and the kid gets the expression on the face that you know they know it's wrong, and you say, don't touch that, and you see that look on the face as the hand moves over to touch it yet once more, and you know it's a battle of wills, and they get a little lashing for that, see? That's all right. That's understandable. That's what we call negative reinforcement, where every time they do that thing, it's bad. The consequences are bad. It doesn't have to be a belt in the jaw. It just has to be a negative. Something happens when a child does something that is wrong. Something happens to reinforce that it's wrong. It doesn't have to be severe. Just consistent. If every time the child gets the hand into that favorite pot of plants, they get the ruler, pretty soon they know that they shouldn't put their hand in that potted plant. And they may test you out on that. But if it's all right some days to put it in the potted plant and some days it's not all right, then they get confused, you see. So you can't just let it go and let it go and then suddenly wallop them with a broadside to the chops, you know. But when they do it, you say, no, that's wrong. And it may just take no. And over again, say, no, that's not right. And you think it's not doing any good, but it is, because it's just it puts a groove there. It puts a steady, consistent groove that says, this is not good conduct. That's for children, for little ones, and that's the way they have to be handled. As a young person gets older, then you have to come at them in a little different way, helping them to understand by the same negative reinforcement. In other words, if there are principles of the household that you're trying to establish, and this is wrong to do this sort of thing. Well, it's always wrong. It's not wrong sometimes and right sometimes and wrong sometimes, because parents have often, as humans, the problem of always putting the weight down when they should be easy and being easy when they should be hard. I mean, there's an inconsistency there that makes the young people confused about it. There's an inconsistency where one of the parents is one way and the other parent's the other way. So those are confusions that are part of the human problem. But Christ does not have that problem of being inconsistent. Now, it comes to the point that you don't need to come to Christ in the fear that he's going to wallop you, but rather in the sense that he is going to try to teach you and correct you. You can make mistakes and still not feel that you have to pack your little bandana and run away from home. People do that, you know. They think, well, I've made this terrible mistake. And they just back away from Christ because they think he surely doesn't want to see them now because they just aren't his type of people. You never like that to Christ. However badly you've fouled up, come to him. Talk to him about it. You can't foul up badly enough that he isn't willing to talk to you. Like, as they say, a good parent that says, don't go to a stranger, come to me, I'll help you. Once again, we're setting the stage for talking to you about principles of behavior and conduct and attitude that are admirable and desirable, but not the prerequisite for God's favor. All right, so now with that basic principle, we go on with these expressions where he says, after he said love is without hypocrisy, or let it be, then he says, fleeing the evil, cleaving to the good. Now, evil, basically in the scripture, has to do with that which is rooted in Satan, that which has Satan as the source. There is much in this world that has fairly harmless overtones, and yet it's rooted in Satan's process. It's Satan's world. If you have Christ in the Spirit, normally you sense that when you're there. For example, whereas it could not be said that a little alcoholic liquid is going to drive a person into hell, you might build a case for saying that there are circles in which, like a bar, for example, places where the influence and the whole atmosphere is so charged with that which is of Satan, there's just a bad place for Christians to spend much time. That is not to say you couldn't drink some liquid and still get to heaven. It is to say that there are contexts in which these things are done that are destructive. Now, it's like with young people and the problem of entertainments. That's a very crucial problem because when they're young, there are lots of things they like to do to be active. I'm going to be very specific here because I think I have to be real and honest with you about these things. Let's take the matter of dancing, for example. It'd be hard to build any kind of case for the fact that the movements of the body, per se, could ever be regarded as, by and large, unwholesome. Else you'd have to rule out basketball games, things like that. But dancing, insofar as it is the graceful body movements, can hardly be all that bad. And two people dancing together under the right conditions, it could hardly be a case could hardly be built for saying that is the root of all evil. But there are, of course, there are ways people can dance together that do have overtones that are bad. But generally speaking, the idea, like, for example, in many kinds of dances among the young people especially, they don't even touch each other much, you know, they just work it out together. But on the other hand, where it takes place, the whole atmosphere in which a lot of this takes place can be very destructive. There are things in this world that are rooted in evil structure that Christians ought not to get involved with. Like I said to my son once again, as a teen, and he was president of a student body and involved in a lot of things. Some of them were all right and some weren't too good, and because young people swung pretty wide in these days. But anyway, I said to him, you know, what you're doing here in this particular matter, I said, maybe 75% of it is fine, harmless. 25% of it will kill you. Therefore, I'm ruling it out. We had a pretty strong discussion about some of those things because it doesn't take a whole lot of poison to destroy you, you see. So, whereas a person can, in some things, I'm not going to be any more specific than that, because I think people have to come to that themselves. But I would just say that there are many things in Satan's world that are so rooted in his spirit and attitude that they are damaging and harmful. And these are things which people ought to stay away from. But, in all honesty, that is not to say that if you walked into a bar sometime, that Christ is going to cluck at you and make you stand in the corner, you see. Christian people ought not to spend time in bars because it's an atmosphere that is destructive. But that is not to say that if you walk into one sometime, you're excommunicated. That's why I'm trying to get across here. These are wise instructions. But they're not the test of whether you're a Christian or not. I've heard many pastors get pretty hot under the collar because someone in their congregation has done this or that, and sometimes people get thrown out of the church for pretty minor, what I would regard as fairly minor offenses, or they have to sign a creed or sign a statement that says, I will never do this and I never do that, see? Which is putting a straitjacket around them and putting a wrong focus. Now, again, remember I'm saying it is wise to follow some of these instructions, to stay as far away from the evil context as is possible. And he says, conversely, to cleave to the good, to go with that which is wholesome and constructive, and to stay away from that which is unwholesome and destructive. If you live long enough, you find that that's pretty wise advice. And I hear so many times people, how can they be a Christian and do that? Easy. They're human beings. And Christianity is not a series of laws as the Old Testament was. It's very pointed in the New Testament that old law has been set aside in the favor of a deeper thing of the heart. So if you get into something that you think maybe later you should not have gotten into, you can expect Christ to be understanding about it. You can talk to him about it and say, I'm not sure that was the best thing to do, but I did it, and that's the way it is. And you may have to have some consequences. Young people, for example, that spend too much time associating with young people that are into trouble are liable to get in trouble. You hop into a car with a gang of kids and rush off to the beach with them, and you don't know particularly what they're going to do or where they're going, you can get in a lot of trouble. And you never intend to at all. And that's the way young people get caught, because they don't intend anything out of order about it, but they just get caught in these situations, and peer pressure is strong, and so forth. So we're not going to vow tonight never to do this or that, but we're only going to say that as human beings, we are subject to difficulty, but we are going to make every effort to live our lives wisely and productively, constructively. So a controlling point here then is keep away from the things that are rooted in Satan's world and cleave to the things that are good. You're going to be far more profited tonight from coming here to listen to the Word than from going to some social soiree somewhere that has quite a mix of people and attitudes and actions. But that is not to say if you went there instead of here, the Lord is going to shut the door in your face, you see. All right, then going on to some of these things that are important. With respect to brotherly love, to hospitality or interaction between persons, he says, being naturally affectionate toward one another. Now, I would say that the Spirit of Christ in us produces an attitude toward people that is an attitude of caring, as we've told you before. It's almost automatic that when the Spirit of Christ comes into us, we begin to care about others. And I notice it in the meetings that people that have just newly come to Christ begin praying for their friends and relatives. And so first thing you know, they're saying, I've got this cousin or nephew or boss or whatever that needs our prayers. There are many, many people that have come to these Bible studies in different communities that have come newly to Christ. That is, we've talked to them and they've come to a meeting and they're just newly identified with Christ. And that's one of the first things I notice, that they begin to care about their family and their friends. One such person that came to Christ paid our way to fly back to his family in the East to talk with him about Christ. And he had just newly come to the Lord. And he wanted his family to have some help and some substantial help. See, there it was, just like that. This person went from a non-caring person, because I knew him before, to a caring person. Now that is natural affection. That's what this word means, to be naturally affection to one another. I don't even remember what the King James says there in verse 10. Somebody has a King James Bible.
Be kindly affectionate one to another with brotherly love and honor, preferring one another.
All right, there's a be kindly affectionate toward one another. You wouldn't understand what that means, I think, in the English. What the Greek means is natural affection, not a phony, superficial veneer, but something from the heart that cares about others. And I submit to you, it isn't something you have to put on, because even though I grant that there are people we don't like because they don't behave ways that are pleasant, they're ugly. There are people that are ugly in behavior. I don't mean in physiognomy. On the other hand, there is in the Christian a natural flow of caring about others, concern for others. And you don't have to be a great, highly spiritualistic person to feel that way. You don't have to run around throwing your arms around people and saying all kinds of sweet things about them, which can itself be phony. I've been in some meetings where that goes on, and I want to run myself. It makes me sick. I look at that, and everybody, that's just part of the meeting. Everybody throw their arms around everybody and shake hands with your friends and all. That's all surface religious claptrap. You'll have to forgive me for saying it, but I'm going to say it anyway. What is being talked about here is that genuine spirit of caring what happens to people instead of being totally self-oriented. Like my father used to say, I don't go around calling everybody brother, but I try to treat them like one. And you get that syrupy, sickening molasses flavor in some circles that is all surface, trying to be very, very spiritual. And it's a euphoria. You can get it in a rock concert the same way you can get it in a church. People get buoyed up by the spirit of the moment. It's a psychological high, euphoria. And everybody's into it, so everybody does it. It's like this, the love-ins they used to have in the hippie team. Hippies used to go on one better up in Haight-Ashbury as far as love children were concerned. So they're not doing anything really holy when they get into a church somewhere and do all that. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about a genuine spirit of caring about others. You don't even have to smile if you don't want to, or shake anybody's hand, but you care what happens to them. I'm going to stop. Father, we thank you for these words tonight, and we do pray that we may get the picture, and that the Spirit of Christ will move within us to fulfill his purpose in our lives. In his name we pray. Amen.